Hello and welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I am joined by Martin Freedom Willis. Hey there, Martin.
Yeah, I like that. That's good timing for me, man.
Yeah, because you got a lot going on. You're freed from some stuff, so that's freedom in your life, but also because of July 4th, and I know you're a true blue American who loves his freedom like the rest of us, right?
That's right. But what you... I'm not freshly divorced or anything like that, just for anyone out there. Not
all right.
That I really care or anything. But no, I'm free from my startup company, which... Hooray!
Yeah. Well, you don't know that there's not, you know, women across the country listening to your show and our show, and they've seen your picture, and they you know, have some crush. You might have a bit of a fan base there.
Well, to be honest with you, I have gotten a few lovely emails.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Nice. See? So those girls, you just broke their hearts. His freedom is not that he's single, but that he has gotten free and clear to do some other work.
That's right.
That's awesome. Well, congratulations, buddy.
Thank you. I'm very happy.
All right. Well, Martin and I will talk some more about UFO news that's happened in the past week or so. However, I want to talk first about our guest for today, and I'm really excited to have him. And I do this a lot, and you guys probably have heard me say this before. There are certain people, well, there's a lot of people I talk to on a regular basis throughout this field, and a lot of times I assume this person has been on the show before. And I'll be like, hey, let's have you on the show again. I've never been on your show. And then I feel like a chump, and I'm like, oh, man, I can't believe it. And this is one of those guys, Ron Reger. I've known him for years. I've known him through MUFON, but he's come to, like, the UFO Congress before we even were running it. And the other group was, he would go to that. He would go to the MUFON symposiums. So I've known him for a long time, a good guy. And when I do research, his name comes up a lot, because that's what's so interesting about Ron, is that he's had a lot of associations with some of these cases that are really big throughout his life. And the reason being, he's an aerospace engineer. So he's retired now, but he served a long career as an aerospace engineer. We'll talk about that, starting with working on projects with NASA, working on top secret projects for defense and stuff like this. You know, usually jets, planes, satellites, space stations, all of this stuff. But so... what's interesting, he's kind of always been in the right place at the right time, if you'd want to say. So, for instance, he was working at Kirtland Air Force Base on some projects when the whole Paul Benowitz Doty thing happened. And, of course, we've talked at length about that, where, you know, Richard Doty was saying that all this crazy stuff, trying to make this Paul Benowitz guy believe there were aliens, because he says Paul Benowitz was seeing some of these top secret projects at the base, and they didn't want the Russians to know about it, all of this kind of stuff. But Bob Lazar, he knew Bob Lazar before Bob Lazar was talking about Area 51 and aliens. I mean, he said he, you know, was a skeptic, and we'll talk about that. And Roswell, he even knows, you know, at least one or two of the key players with Roswell, and has some interesting things to share there. In fact, it was in Roswell where I most recently saw him, because, as you know, I was there a couple weekends ago doing a talk. Well, just last weekend. And so was Ron. So I got to catch up with him some more and, you know, refresh my memory on some of these stories. And I thought, hey, I should have Ron on the show again. And that's when I realized I've never had him on in the first place. What's my problem? So, yeah, super interesting career associated with these great UFO cases. So I think you guys are going to find this terribly interesting. I certainly do. So that'll be a lot of fun. So we'll have that interview coming up in a minute. But before that, let's get back to Martin and talk some UFO news. So, Martin, there's a lot that's been going on. In fact, you know, I do news on your show, and I think I have totally different stories already from what I talked about on your show to talk about here, because there's been actually, even though sometimes it feels slow, there's always something going on. And the cool thing, we have Roger Marsh writing about MUFON cases, and they've always got cases coming in. So is there something, a piece of news that has particularly caught your eye?
Yes, siree. And that's the title is Watergate's Hunt, Allegedly Believed Kennedy Assassination Tied to Alien Revelations.
Right. Yeah. Tell us about this.
Well, it's this is according to Watergate lawyer and author Douglas Caddy. American intelligence officer E. Howard Hunt, well known for his plumber's role in the Nixon White House, he revealed that John Kennedy, this is according to Caddy, that he revealed that John Kennedy was killed for his attempts to expose the reality of the alien presence and to share it with the Russian Cold War adversaries. And there is a Freedom of Information Act released memo that, now I'm going to say alleged because I can't tell you if this is authentic or not. There's some redaction on it, and that is also in this article. But boy, is that an interesting read! If you know whether it's real or not, it's a great read. And that's in the article right on your website. Did you think that document is? What do you think about the document? I should say.
The document, you know, is Kennedy saying, "Hey, I want to know some information on UFOs." November 12, 1963. Allegedly, it was supposedly found by an author when he was writing a book. However, William Lester. However, it looks like I did a lot of research on this, and I had in the past, and I just wanted to see if I could find any more. But the problem is, no one else has been able to get this document, and official. You know, the government's even saying, we don't think that's true. So we kind of have to go by the word of this, of William Lester, that this document's true, but no one can verify that this document's real, as far as I know. And listeners or any researchers out there who know differently, let me know, because I have not found any, you know, confirmation that this document is a real document. So, it's hard to say. So, you know, there are other researchers who use this document and to say that, oh, that must be why Kennedy was killed. This guy, Douglas Caddy, who's a lawyer, and he was just into this stuff. He tried to represent the plumbers, and he did for a period of time. but he says he told the dark journalist in this conspiracy show, his name is Daniel Litz, the guy who runs it, and he told him that he thinks Kennedy was killed because of the UFOs, and he said Howard Hunt said that. Howard Hunt was a CIA guy who was one of the main organizers of the plumbers in the Watergate scandal and served over a year in prison for the whole thing. But I don't know, you know, this is third person. It's very interesting, of course, because this guy was involved with the whole Watergate thing and everything. But, you know, you read when he made these statements, some of his colleagues, some of the people, you know, close to it even say, well, UFOs probably had something to do with it, but this just definitely wasn't it. And so there has been some dispute. Who knows?
Well, for one thing, when I look at this document, I see that it was not signed by Kennedy. It was just a typed signature, and that I think that to me says it's a little bit suspicious. And are you saying that right now, if you through the FOIA if you try to get this document. They're saying that it doesn't exist. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I honestly have not read from anybody who a direct quote from someone who tried to do it. However, I have heard responses from these departments who they allegedly released this document, and they have said that this document is not real. So that's the hard part.
Right.
In fact, I think I have a link to some more research, from Live Science, where they looked into it and where they couldn't verify it as being real either, and how they were told also by the government that they don't think this is real. So it's a tough one. I don't know. So, yeah, the document's hard to verify. Howard Hunt is dead, so it's impossible to verify, you know, his statement there. So, but it's interesting that this guy's saying that for sure.
I mean, he could be just trying to sell a book. Who knows?
Yeah.
But it's a take that hasn't been, you know, really looked at before, I don't think. And, you know, there was conspiracy. One of the conspiracy theories is that KGB was, you know, responsible for Kennedy's assassination. And that wouldn't really work with this document either. You know, he's trying to work with the Russians. So it's a little suspicious.
Yeah, the Kennedy thing is just as mysterious as anything else. There's so many theories as to who wanted him dead and who might have killed him. It's hard to know. But what do you think? Do you think that it was Oswald working all on his own?
You know, I'm probably going to get hate mail for saying this, but I think it was.
Really?
Yeah. Is that a conspiracy?
That is anti-conspiracy.
I guess. You know, I think it's possible. I mean, you know, I mean, a lot of people say he couldn't get those rounds off in a short time, but and the way he did and all that, and the gun wasn't real accurate and all that. So there is possibilities, but people have tried to replicate what he's done, and they've been there's one team that's been able to do it. So, I mean, it is, it's all possible. So I should probably just say that I don't know. That's probably, I'm just going to take back what I said earlier.
No, you can't do that. Stand up for your beliefs. I'm 80-20.
Okay. And
80% though that it's probably more than Oswald. But still not close. Yeah, still not sure. You know, I think it might have been possible. I'm not 100%.
Yeah. Well, it's another thing we will never know.
Yep. All right. So moving on, the next piece of news. This is a lot of fun, especially given that Comic-Con is going on right now. And what was funny is when I posted this story, people were really excited and like, oh, that's really cool. But if you read the story, I think especially as a UFO researcher, you'll feel that it's not very cool at all. And that is the Welsh government replying to UFO questions in Klingon. And, of course, that's fun. I've got this picture of Worf, and he seems shocked that the Welsh government would do this. And I feel the same way as Worf does here. You know, because of Comic-Con and Star Trek lovers, that's fun. But the problem is that, you know, there was an assembly minister in Wales who was very seriously for his constituents asking some questions about UFOs. He said, you know, do we know how many reports of UFOs have happened over Cardiff Airport? What discussion has the Welsh government had with the Ministry of Defense regarding UFOs? And what considerations has the Welsh government given to finding research into UFOs? And so really, you know, some pretty cool questions from this minister, Darren Millar, who's a Tory. You've probably heard that term and wondered what the heck it means. It means a conservative. But unfortunately, when they responded, the Welsh government responded in Klingon, which is fun. But of course, they're doing it to make fun of him. The response was the minister, what it translated to. I can try to say it in Klingon.
Jang vida je du luk ak gatvam ikia.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah, you should do VO, man.
How's that sound? So I don't know if that's in the Klingon or not. You know, I'm sure we'll have some response from people who are fluent in Klingon, because there are these people. But it translates into, the minister will reply in due course. However, this is a non-devolved matter. They're expecting to give a more full answer July 15th. And one of the people, there was an assembly person, an unnamed source, who said, the only extraterrestrial life seen near Cardiff recently seems to be Darren Miller, the minister who asked the questions about the UFOs. Perhaps instead of spending time and wasting government resources asking questions about UFOs, he should be fighting for the very real concerns of his constituents.
Wow.
That's pretty harsh.
It is. Do you think this is going to affect his political career? Like they say, stay away from this, you know?
You know what? It's really difficult to say. And what's interesting, and I wrote this in the story, if you go to our headlines page right now, you know, we post every day news headlines out there about UFOs from mainstream media. And the UK, especially right now, is UFO crazy. They're running daily stories. Like the Daily Mirror, the Daily Express, two big papers over there in the UK especially, run daily stories on UFOs. In fact, they pick up a lot of our stories. Luckily, they usually credit us, even though not everyone does. But like our June increase in UFO reporting, these guys all printed stories about it. And most, except for people like Yahoo News, gave us credit. But they're writing, if you go there, you're going to see the vast majority in the past week, especially, I would say 90% of the UFO stories in mainstream media come from the UK, that many. So there are a lot of people interested in it. I also quoted a poll that Lee Spiegel wrote about in 2012, where it said 52% of the people believe UFO evidence have been covered up because of widespread knowledge of their existence would threaten government stability. And this is a UK poll that was done. So I don't know if it will hurt him. In fact, maybe it would endear him to the people. And he was asking about real concerns his constituents had. That's where he got these concerns. So this is interesting, too. Nick Pope tweeted about it. And he said, replying to an assemblyman's question on UFOs in Klingon is a great way to ridicule the subject. I did similar things at the MOD, Kapla, which is a Klingon word.
I thought it would be. Yeah.
Which means success. So he's just saying how this method, which he Lee Spiegel also wrote about this, which he told Lee Spiegel was called spin and dirty tricks, where they would ridicule the topic right off the bat so no one would pay attention to it anymore. And he's saying that they did the same thing, and it worked. So I have some of the quotes from the story about how Nick Pope did this sort of thing. In fact, we're going to interview him tomorrow and have him on our UFO report that we'll put up on YouTube later this week about this matter. But essentially he's saying, yeah, it's just a good way to kind of diffuse the whole thing by making fun of it right off the bat. So
sure.
So, yeah, what an interesting story, though, huh?
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
It's, we'll see what happens. You know, I hope you're right about, you know, endearing him even more to the public, because it wasn't a silly question. It was just responded to silly.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's endeared himself to me.
Good.
Yeah.
What Except about, you have no voting rights, but
I have no voting rights, but you know what? I would give the guy an attaboy for being brave enough to ask the questions for his constituents. And of course his opponents with the probably expectation his opponents would jump on it to make fun of him, which they did.
Mm.
Otherwise, in other UFO news, you know, we've talked a lot already. You know, we've had these two stories, which were pretty involved, very interesting. So we spent a lot of time. But just a heads up, there are a couple great stories that we have posted from the week. Like I had talked about, June did have a lot of UFO sightings reported. You know, I think I talked about this on the last show, and it was mostly due, Roger Marsh says, to Hangar One.
Right.
It had two episodes in June all about sightings, and they got a lot of calls. And the reason they know this or suspect this is that, I did do a graph to see where the sightings were, and they were pretty much everywhere across the board, which just which helps bolster, their idea about it being Hangar One. And a lot of their reports were anecdotal, so happening years ago. So Roger wrote about a couple of those, some of them really interesting, like this giant disc going around this rocket tower, this testing site. Mm-hmm. So kind of interesting. Other interesting stories there. We also have some recent sightings that of triangular craft. One guy in Jersey who took some pictures of three orbs. These orbs kind of do look like Chinese lanterns, but he says they didn't move out of formation. They were all in a formation, and he began to think then that they were dark, they're one object. So he wrote about that, which is interesting. And then there's another guy in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, who says at about 10 p.m., he sees triangular UFOs often. So I was able to find a clock from Phoenixville. It even says Phoenixville. That says 10:10. But I think that's a.m. because it's light out. But I was happy to find this picture. That's why I'm telling you about it. But, interesting story. You could read about that. So some other interesting sightings that we have posted. So there we go. There's some news for you, people.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. News. Well, thank you once again for joining us, Martin. I'm sure you have another exciting guest lined up for your podcast UFO this week.
Erica Lukes.
Oh, Erica. Great. So yeah. She was in our first our first UFO reports on YouTube, so people awesome. Can go check that out. But I guess we will talk to you later, my friend. Thanks for joining us again.
You bet. I'll talk to you next week.
Okay, so let's go ahead and talk to Ron Regeer. I am very excited to be joined by Ron Regeer. Hello, Ron.
Hello, Alejandro.
So
beautiful day in Arizona here.
Yeah, it is. You're in Flagstaff, right?
It is.
Uh-huh. So you're a little cooler than we are down here in the valley in the Phoenix area, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's 88 right now.
Wow, perfect. And, for people who don't know, like, Arizona is not all barren desert like it is in the Phoenix area where it's like, in the 100 pluses, like 110 degrees or something. The Flagstaff area is very mountainous with lots of pines. Similar to like Sholo, where people know where the Travis Walton stuff happened. And it's very pretty, and that's where we escape to in this area on the weekends when we can to escape the heat. But it's real pretty out there.
I'm about 50 miles south of Flagstaff and about 4,000 feet elevation just north of Camp Verde. So mm-hmm. I'm about in a transitory zone. I've got mixed cactus and a few smaller trees, but not the big pines, but it's quite pleasant here today.
Yeah, 88, that's perfect. That's great. So, and 88 is great for Arizonans like us in Phoenix. For some places it may seem hot, but for Phoenix residents, that's like perfect.
Yeah, our relative humidity is 7% today, so it's very dry.
Wow.
So the heat isn't nearly as oppressive as it is when it's a higher humidity.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very dry for the monsoon season, so we're enjoying it while we can because we know it'll get overcast, rainy, humid, and then back to 105 again. So
yeah.
We're enjoying this one today.
Well, I'm really excited to talk to you. I like we talked about before we started the show, I'm surprised I haven't had you on before because I've known you for years and we talk occasionally. And you've got such an interesting background in the aerospace industry, right?
Yes. I started out right out of college working as all engineers start working on a drafting board then. I don't know what they do now because it's been too many years to count. So one of the first things I did was I was assigned to the team to do the interface wiring between the Saturn Apollo third stage and the second stage, which was all the control signals and telemetry the computers were monstrous in size. The one at the college would heat up the entire school. It was so big.
Wow.
And it was probably less computing power than most people's smartphones. But it was a gee whiz thing. We built the moon rocket with slide rules and 3-9 key adding machines. So shows you how far we've progressed.
Yeah, incredible.
I went from there over to work on designing our nation's first space station called Skylab. We called it the Orbital Workshop at the time.
Huh.
And that was where we were successful. I hesitate to use the term too successful, but back in the 60s, it was quite common to have our rockets explode on the launch pad.
Hmm.
So we originally designed and built 17 moon rockets with the idea that we would have about a one-third failure rate.
Wow.
And so when we talk about the astronauts being brave, that's not just something we say lightly. We've both seen the Challenger accident, or the audience has, and other tragic failures. But back then it was even more so. And as it is, we got off our launches with absolute wonderful success. And so we had a surplus of vehicles. Now, anybody that's worked with the government knows that surpluses are not something you want to have, because that looks bad for the taxpayers and looks bad for the people who submit all the costs. So we decided that what we would do is use the first two stages of the Saturn V, launch the third stage dry, where meaning it had no fuel, no oxidizer, and we jammed a bunch of instrument packages in there and put it into low Earth orbit. And it was our first space station. The astronauts conducted a series of experiments. It was really a groundbreaking event. That was, I wrote the specs on that and was part of the design team on that.
Pretty cool.
Had an interesting kickoff for my college to getting right in with getting both feet wet, working on some really exciting stuff.
Mm-hmm. So at then what?
After,
Go ahead.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I want to hear what happened next or what you did next.
I transferred over to Douglas Long Beach. It was a sort of an accident. I went over there to deliver some technical classified information on another program, the Manned Orbiting Laboratory. And my former boss saw me and thought I was too embarrassed to ask him for a job. So he called my boss back at Huntington Beach and said, "Don't lay off Ron Regeer. I've got a job for him over here." So I ended up getting a transfer over. It turns out they were looking to lay off somebody. And since I already had a job, they wouldn't have to terminate an employee. So I transferred over to where they made airplanes and got a job there working on designing the instrumentation packages for the first spy aircraft, the DC-8 with the big radome on top. Unfortunately, Boeing got that contract. That's the AWACS that you guys have heard of and seen flying around on occasion. So I went from there, since I now had a background in, quote, surveillance, you know, working on a failed project. I got hired in at a company called Aerojet, where I stayed for 30-plus years, designing different observation platforms, sensor systems, and surveillance satellites. That was a fun part.
Mm-hmm. So when was it? So when was it that you got interested in UFOs?
Back in the 1950s.
Wow.
That was when they had all the cheesy Class B movies, remember?
Yeah.
I Married a Monster, all the real cheesy ones. I thought, this is so cool. And all the flying saucers were really crummy looking. By today's standards, they wouldn't even be able to show something like that. People would either, maybe they think it was so camp that they had to watch it, but most people would look at it and say, you know, this is so phony.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, that got me started, and as I got more and more interested in these things. There were actually several news reports a year on flying saucers and things like that. And as a result, I got more and more interested, and it became a matter of theirs can outperform ours, and how do they do that?
Mm-hmm.
Which led to my going to school, become an aeronautical astronautical engineer.
Wow.
Actually led into my background.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I got into working and building and designing surveillance satellites, that was the perfect platform to see if we could actually see these pesky little things bothering us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I got into, tied it in. And one of the major discoveries I made was that we did, in fact, see the Iranian UFO that flew over Tehran, Iran in 1976.
You saw it with your with a satellite?
Yeah, with our spy satellite. Yeah, we saw that.
So were you able, did they capture images?
No, this was, it was a infrared satellite. We picked up the infrared radiation emitting from the UFO, and that's what we saw. Interestingly
wow.
enough, many in your audience probably know Colonel John Alexander. And as I gave a presentation on this in Lafayette, I think it was in 2001, but I'm not sure. After the presentation, John came up to me and said, I have something to show you. And so he presented me with a line sketch of the same UFO that had been detected by another government sensing platform.
Wow.
That was kind of cool.
Wow. So, and just to give people some information, this, the Tehran, wasn't that 1976 that happened?
Yes, it was.
Uh-huh. Where they scrambled some jets to chase an object, and I think it was the typical, you know, it outmaneuvered them, and the U.S. government, it turns out, contacted them, and it was one of those things where the U.S. government was interested in investigating this UFO case.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
There was even more drama from the standpoint that two of the different fighter jets, they were F-4s, which was our frontline fighter at the time, actually achieved what is called radar lock. That's when the radar picks up the target and the weapon system, in this case rockets, are also locked in, where they now target now lock in and onto the target, which is where the operator pilot normally fires a weapon. But in every single case of these incidents in Tehran, as soon as they achieved radar lock on the target, all the aircraft electrical systems went dead.
Mm-hmm.
And we could do that. It latches up the electronics, but the amazing thing for me was that after the plane ceased being a threat, the electronics came back on. We don't know how to turn it back on. We could freeze up by melting the electrodes and things and turn them off, but we can't turn it back on.
Wow.
That was an amazing little snippet that came on, which may be what really garnered the military's interest more so than the UFOs themselves, because I believe they've been following and tracking and witnessing UFOs for 30 years by that time.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the first time we actually had to disable our weapon systems and enable them further down. So,
mm-hmm. So that data that you all received with your satellite, what happened to that as far as you know?
The data went on to wherever the data goes. There were four offices back in the military where our satellite data went, and it just sort of died a quiet death.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked personally with the pilots. Buffon had them at a symposium a few years back, and I sat down and talked with them. And what was interesting was it wasn't just, you know, black in the middle of the night and Billy Bob and Joe with a six-pack of beer watching. There were over 500,000 people in Tehran that were... It lasted for about 30 minutes up on the rooftops watching this attempt. When they were going over the speed of sound, windows were broken as the jets succeeded Bach. And, I mean, this was a major event. Airlines were diverted to avoid getting tangled up in this. It was a lot more than just a byline on a Saturday night news broadcast. It was a really spectacular major event.
So did
it suggest that the DIA did, in fact, look into it.
Right. And did they ever, did you have any trepidation about sharing that information when you did your report and your talk on it? Did anybody tell you shouldn't do that?
No, they the closest I got, and the reason was I got all my information from unclassified sources.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I knew where the unclassified sources were, which helps. But the data I got was all from an unclassified report that was a summary report. As a result of my divulging what I did, they changed the content of that summary report called the Itty Bitty Individual Target Event Database, is what the acronym was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a one-line entry for everything that our satellites spotted. But there was enough information on there to correlate it with that event. And so that was... changed the report to delete the time after that. I believe it was the time they deleted the next series.
Oh, really? Wow. So you have evidence there of a little cover-up, essentially.
Yeah, that's not the first.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting. I was one of the Air Force guys that came out to interview me was Captain James Kirk.
Really?
Really. That's what I said. And he just kind of shook his head. He said, I know. And he opened his wallet, pulled out a couple of credit cards, his driver's license, along with his, he showed me his military ID first, and others corroborating identification. He says, I get this all the time. I wish that show had been canceled.
Mm-hmm. That's really funny.
But they were primarily concerned is where I got my information, and I showed them where I got it, and it was all unclassified. I said, thank you very much, and that was the end of it.
Wow, interesting. So you've had so many interesting, things that you've been related to. It's funny because when I do my research, your name comes up so often. But, this is something I've never asked you about and I've wanted to is I know you've got some sort of connection, correct, with Richard Doty. Did you know him or were you working at Kirtland at the time? Or what is your connection like to him and to what he was doing?
Okay, well, that was interesting in that there's a back. Personally, I never met Richard Doty, and I never talked with him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that in retrospect, looking back on it, I can see where that connection could be made. We were conducting some drop tests of a submunition called a SATARM, Sensor Detect Armor, at Coyote Canyon at Kirtland Air Force Base. It was highly instrumented. And at the same time, Paul Benowitz was intercepting alien signals, so he says. And so what happened was the government sort of put two and two together and came up with three, maybe, that our test data signals were being picked up by Paul Benowitz. There was a concern that if Benowitz, sitting in his office outside the gate at Kirtland, he had a pretty big shop making instrumentation packages, could detect the signals, then the Soviets or whoever wanted to could also detect that and possibly compromise our tests or our weapon system. So I started corresponding with Paul Benowitz and Lieutenant, I think it was like Colonel Ernest Edwards, who was Director of Base Security at the time. I believe that was the title.
That sounds right, yeah.
And so, about what was going on. And this was the same time, coincidentally, that Bill Moore was living with Paul Benowitz as his guest.
Hmm.
And Bill Moore was working with or sharing information with Lee Graham and I about NJ-12 and Snowbird and some of the other contentious documents that were floating around about that time. So it was pretty busy hopping between MJ-12, Bill Moore, and then Bill Moore being right there with Benowitz when we were looking into this. And I got the impression it was Doty or somebody working with or for Doty that was doing the shenanigans with Paul Benowitz that would eventually led to him, I think he just went crazy.
Right.
He would do things like... Paul would leave for the day with Bill, and Bill would come back, and they would do something like rearrange all the furniture in the living room. Nothing else, just put the easy chair and everything in different places. And then the next day, they'd put the change the silverware drawers or put the silverware in a different drawer. The other day, put the cups and saucers in a different pantry. Move everything around in the refrigerator and rearrange the shelves. Nothing that was really damaging, but enough to really play on somebody's mind. What's going on here? I know when I open this cupboard, I reach in, I can do it in the dark and pick up a glass to get a drink of water. And I reach in there and it's pots and pans or something. I don't know the specifics, but you can imagine how that would be so disconcerting. That's what they were doing.
So, I mean, just to catch up the listeners, of course, they've heard me talk a lot about this. For those listeners who, like about a year ago when I was really covering this, when I had written a report. But, Richard Doty claims that, like you said, they knew that Benowitz was getting data from the base. And so in order to throw him off, they tried to make him think that, I guess, signals from your projects and maybe photos of your project and possibly others were extraterrestrial in nature. And then he recruited Bill Moore to help him, who was an author and UFO investigator and secretly. And that they messed with this poor guy and drove him crazy. He eventually went nuts. It's so sad. And according to Doty, it was, something he was doing on orders. But you were talking essentially with, that, and this is a guy whose name comes up because supposedly, he was in charge of base security, Ernest Edwards. In your discussion with Edwards, did you get the impression that Edwards was trying to mess with Benowitz, that this was something official Doty was doing? Because that's still up in the air.
No, I didn't, but I didn't. That didn't come in our discussion. I went over to visit with Edwards and sat down in his office and showed him some pictures. And I said, "Is this you? And is that a UFO?" And he says, "Well, I don't know what it is. So I guess it's a UFO. It's unidentified. I didn't see it, but as you can see, my back's to the object in the photograph, which it was." And now, I said, there's something else that Paul told me. He says, this is when I'm talking with Edwards. I said, Paul told me that you went with him, or you took him on an Air Force helicopter up to Mount Manzano to personally eyeball these strange happenings up there. And he said, yes. So I said, it did happen. He said, yes. And I said, he also said that while you were going up there, that your radar detector picked up something under intelligent control. And I said, is that true? He said, yes. I said, how do you know it was under intelligent control? And he said, well, we had a radar set at 10 miles, and one scan, it did not pick it up, and the next scan, it was about 4 foot away from our helicopter. He said, if it wasn't under intelligent control, he said, it would have probably hit us, but it stopped right there as if it was looking at us and then went away.
Did you see this object?
No, I didn't. That was just not. I was thought. Paul had talked about mentioned it, and in one of his letters to me. And I eventually kept all his letters. I lost some of the first ones, but I eventually kept them all. And they make interesting reading. And to this day, the biggest problem Paul had, I think, was he was somewhat striped in getting Pete Domenici was, I think, U.S. Senator for New Mexico mm-hmm. at the time, and he was writing Pete Domenici all the time. He had photographs in which he saw things that I could not see, even with the four-power loop,
mm-hmm.
the crashed rocket ship, and beautiful line drawings, and here's the alien teleporter. It looked like a little... looked like a Roman chariot without any wheels or horses, just a little cubicle in which two aliens would stand side by side and fly around. You know, there's a pencil sketch, just, you know, it's made. Yet I couldn't see any of this stuff in the photos, and these are high-res photos.
Mm-hmm.
So the last thing I did with Paul was I wanted him to take some extremely high-res film. Extremely sensitive, falls way into the infrared region but still visible. And I wrapped it in lead and sent him instructions to load it quickly, take his pictures, wrap it back in lead foil, and return it to me, and I'll process the film. And that cost me a bundle back then. I forget the name of the film, but it was a specialty film that I talked to some guys about. And I never heard from him again. I don't know if he ever used the film. I don't even know if he got the film. But the next I heard was he had been committed, and his family didn't want anybody to attempt to contact him or them. And I respected that, and then I heard he'd passed. So that was the end of the Vinowitz saga from my perspective.
Having seen this shenanigans. Yeah, and having to see that this scandal and the tragedy surrounding this situation, how then did that shade your view of like the alleged MJ-12 documents and other materials that came out of this kind of whole thing?
I was pretty well convinced the MJ-12 documents were, especially the Eisenhower briefing document, was valid, legitimate. I don't believe for one minute it's a hoax or a counterfeit. There's too many other things, like I think it's Professor Walcott, I believe his name. I could be wrong. I don't have my notes with me.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it was ostensibly written by Admiral Hillenkoetter, who was, I believe, the first director of the CIA, and he presented, Stan Friedman actually did the groundwork, presented many samples of known authentic Hillenkoetter writing to Westcott or Wolcott, I forget the professor's name, but he was a recognized authority. His testimony has been and used in a court of law to authenticate documents prepared by a specific author based on writing style. And he, without any hesitation or equivocation, said the MJ-12 documents were written by Hillenkoetter. That doesn't mean that they presented to Eisenhower, but that was what was confirmed.
That's strange. Oh, well. I think there's... I don't understand why Hillenkoetter would write something like this. I mean, typically, a general isn't writing his technical data or something like that. But for the listeners, if they don't remember, what's weird about it, too, is, you know, Doty admits to hoaxing and making Benowitz believe there's aliens. He recruits Bill Moore. And then, coincidentally, it's Bill Moore and his partner who received these MJ-12 documents, supposedly coming from Albuquerque, where Doty lives and works at Kirtland Air Force Base.
Yeah, it was bizarre. The whole thing, the whole set of circumstances are just...
mind-boggling.
Almost incomprehensible.
Yeah. It's really hard. And there's another case like that that you also have some incredible insight to. And that is this whole Area 51 and Bob Lazar case. So you were friends with John Lear, who was friends with Bob Lazar in Las Vegas.
Right.
How did you become friends with him? Were you working in Vegas for a while?
No. It was John Andrews. John Andrews was vice president of Tester Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow he got my name and wanted my interest in UFOs. And I think it was, I don't know. But anyway, John and I started corresponding, and he says, well, let me find those things up in Nevada. There's a secret test site up there, and John Lear knows all about it. So we agreed, John Andrews and I agreed to go up with Lee Graham to John Lear's house and find out if we could find out more about two things he was looking at, the stealth fighter and UFOs.
And this is before people knew about the stealth fighter, probably, and before people knew about Area 51, right?
Right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was just, nobody was talking about it. It was, if they knew about it, it was, who cares, you know, it's like any other airplane.
So what was this, early 80s, maybe, or?
About mid-80s, about 1986, 87, right in there.
Mm-hmm.
And we went up, and guy comes over and he's laughing at us, but you guys are all delusional, you're crazy, I'm a physicist, there's, you know, the physics says they can't do this. And his name was Bob Lazar. And he laughed, you know, we'd all have a good, you know, good time together. It was all friendly bantering. It wasn't any table pounding, yelling, screaming, none of that. It was all friendly. And if you've been in John Lear's office or den or whatever you want, man cave, you'd see, I mean, it's got 21, 20 is the number, is the Aviation International, FIE, whatever that acronym stands for in French, but it's an international organization that licenses all manner of things aviation. And he has everything except multiple rocket engine instructor and helicopter instructor. I think those are the two that he doesn't have. The parachute rigger, all those licenses or certificates that they're, you know, and they're all on the right below the ceiling, all around his office. That he's got pictures of about anything and everything you can think of related to aeronautics and airplanes. I mean, some of them are really mind-boggling. And it's in this context, and then he's got a big desk, and he's got like five or six monitors to tune to different TV stations all the time.
Huh.
And something will happen, we'll say, whoa. So anyway, it was a very relaxed atmosphere, but Bob Lazar was just, you know, you guys are crazy. There's no such thing as UFOs. I would know about it. The physics says you can't do it. And okay, Bob, that's fine. Yeah, what about the stealth fighter? And there was some, you know, that's possible. And that John Andrews wanted to develop the two things he wanted before he died was to make a tester model of a stealth fighter and a tester model of a real UFO. So that was where we were looking at all this, and we're going to go out to Area 51, and we drove right out to the, at that time you could drive right out to the base of the dry bed, lake bed.
Wow.
And all the way across the Groom Lake, which is a dry lake bed, to the buildings on the other side, right up on a BLM road. So it just follows, and you can see a dust plume coming across the desert, and this Jeep, it turned out to be. So I took the film out of the camera and stuck it in the box, and the little paper, instruction paper, stuck all of that in the between the seat of the back seat and the back of the back seat, that little crack back seat. I jammed all that back in there, loaded another roll of film in my camera, started taking pictures again. This very angry, upset air policeman came up and, give me your camera. And I said, wait a minute, I'm just a working stiff like you are. I know you don't want my camera, you just want the film. And so I opened the back of my camera, and he gleefully ripped the film out and pulled the whole thing out of the film canister, exposed it, threw it down on the floor, and I loaded my camera bag, took all the film out of there, exposed all of that, and said, you know, get away, get out of here. And so we turned around and drove away. He was happy, we were happy, everybody. Nobody got shot. But later on, we messed with them a little bit. We got construction stakes with orange flag tape. You see the big orange tape that sometimes flies in these. Had a field strength meter, and we go around to find all the sensors that they use to track people coming in to trying to sneak in the back of Area 51. And we found a stake about 2 feet away and put some flag tape on it. They didn't like that either. So anyway, that was my first exposure. And then I guess maybe a month, 2 months later, I was back up there with John. And here comes Bob, and he's very serious in animation. He says, "You guys are right." And he used a few very strong words that you'd have to excise from your tape. But, you know, "You guys are right. There are damn enough flying saucers." And they, you know, he says, "I'm working on one. They fly them every Wednesday night," and all this. So he was on and on. He couldn't believe it. And just very, very exercised. Now, either one of two things happened. Either he really was working on them, or they somehow got to him with either psychotropic drugs or some other method and convinced him of that, because he was extremely sincere. I mean, you could tell by his mannerisms, his interest. It wasn't an act. It wasn't a play. It was real. He was convinced that how flying saucers are real. He was working on one. There was the top hat model, the jello mold model. I believe he said there were 9 of them all sold in this big hangar. And he said, really, Area 51, it's an area south of there called Area S4. And when he came into S4, the whole mountainside would open up. Just imagine for you to drive in and close behind you. And it was heavy stuff.
So when you first met him, you know, prior when he was a skeptic and everything, he said he was a physicist. Did you believe him, and did he demonstrate to you, because you are actually an engineer, that, you know, was he convincing that, did you believe he was a physicist?
Yeah, I didn't know he was a physicist per se, but I knew he was the scientist. He was working on, and was thinking of enlisting me to help him design a bunker buster bomb that would penetrate, I think it was 1,500 feet of soil and mixed gravel and explode an underground bunker. And he was thinking he could do that if he rocket powered it and then deflected the exhaust through the nose of the rocket to melt the gravel and rock. So it was just, when we were sitting around in John's den, and whatever, kind of shooting the breeze.
So you guys were kind of talking shop, and he was able to keep up. He knew the language, and you had no reason to doubt that he was a physicist then.
None whatsoever. None whatsoever. He was saying the right thing at the right time. I don't remember the specifics, but it was, he seems like it was that of that type that knew what he was talking about.
Did he say where he was working at that time?
I believe he was freelancing, doing his own thing. He just left New Mexico, Los Alamos, sometime before. And I got the impression he was looking for a job. By the way, if you ever get a chance, he has one hell of a 4th of July party.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He worked his way through college making and selling fireworks for these municipal displays.
Oh, wow.
One heck of a show. You tell us, save your toilet paper and paper towel tubes, and we'll make skyrockets and grenades out of them. Grenades skyrocket talk as they go up and explode, as opposed to things you throw at the enemy.
Wow.
And then they had an old 50 caliber machine gun. You could pay $1 a round to shoot at an old wrecked car a mile away across the lake bed.
Wow, you're kidding. Wow.
So, I mean, he not only had the seriousness side, he also had a lot of fun toys. Mm-hmm. You go along the desert, pick up the clips that hold the 50 caliber rounds together from the old gunnery ranges, and then reloaded his own 50 caliber shells, cast his own lead bullets, and it was fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what's interesting about that is that, you know, we talked this weekend, we were both in Roswell, and about Jeremy Corbell, who we did an interview on UFO, or UFO Report on YouTube, but it's also, you know, he was on Coast to Coast talking about how he found a physicist who says that Bob Lazar worked at Los Alamos and he knew him there. And he said Bob Lazar was kind of a rock star because he had built a jet car. But it seems like, you know, I always hear these stories like you're telling of Bob Lazar into these crazy, you know, kind of fun, silly things, which kind of made him notable.
Yeah, he had a jet car. I did not drive it. Mm-hmm. And he also had a rocket or jet go-kart.
Oh, wow.
That had a rocket mounted on a tripod stand above the go-kart. And then the driver would sit in the go-kart with a 5-pound or 5-gallon canister of propane between your legs. And as you crack the valve, somebody would stand at the rear of the rocket with a welder's igniter, a welding torch igniter, and let off a spark or two until the propane let off. And then off across the desert, you'd fly. Your hindquarters about 3 inches off the desert, and it'll go a regular little go-kart. And he got up to 90 miles an hour.
Wow.
The faster you go, or to open the valve on the propane, the faster you go. I never had the nerve to do that, but
yeah,
several of the guys did.
I don't think I would either. So he said that these tests were happening on Wednesdays, and I know John Lear went out there, right? And I think his friend Gene Huff. Did you ever go out to look at these tests?
No, I did. I went out to attempt to one time, and I've heard stories about it. Going out there, it said an A-7 flew over them at Mach and scared the water out of them. And
wow.
Then, I don't know whether it's air police or BLM people were on the east side of the road and turned their headlights on. So they hopped in their cars and started driving out of the play area. And as they're doing 40, 50 miles an hour on this dirt road, the BLM and police and air police, everybody's driving across the desert terrain, bouncing around. It's one of those things you kind of wish you had gone, and other times you wish you didn't. When they got to the end of the road, the deputy was there, blocking the road, and had a nice discussion with all of them.
Wow. Yeah, so some crazy experiences. So did you ever, did you talk to Lazar then after he got busted, essentially?
No, he sort of just fell out of... I've talked to him several times since, and yeah, but not immediately.
Mm-hmm.
He came out to my house in Moab to get some uranium. He was still working on selling his Geiger counters, and Geiger counters need a source to determine if they're working properly.
Mm-hmm.
And so that source is a piece of radioactive material. And after 9/11, that's very difficult to get hold of because there's extremely strict controls. So Bob came out to Moab, where I live, which was uranium capital of the world at one time. And we went out to some of the old uranium mines and picked up ore from there. And so he loaded that in the back end of his car. And then he just, by chance, got his ventilator out and said, "Whoa, this is so hot, I don't think we should sit in the back seat for very long."
Oh, wow.
And I told his lady companion, I said, "You ought to talk him into getting a bunch of leaded glass crystal, because that with a lead would stop the radioactivity, and it would provide a nice barrier, then you could always use it for fine dining later." Bob didn't like that. I think it was too expensive.
That's pretty funny. Wow, incredible.
Some pretty neat story. So, as far as you're convinced, I mean, you met him, you saw him before and after. You know, he allegedly worked on these projects, and you believe him.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Absolutely. Pretty. I guess they either experienced what he experienced, or in some very, very sophisticated and extremely effective way, they manipulated him outside of his awareness, and he sincerely believes what it is. Uh-huh. I don't know. You know, I have no way of knowing which one from the other.
You know, this question comes to mind. You being someone who worked on aerospace projects and many of these defense projects, you know, even NASA and everything, you know, Bob Lazar, having gotten in trouble for speaking about the secret projects he was working on, is it surprising to you, because it seems somewhat surprising that now he is, you know, selling equipment, scientific equipment, Geiger counters and the such, like you mentioned, and he still has government contracts. That seems kind of interesting, doesn't it?
Well, he probably never violated his security. See, each contract has certain things that are, they define what is classified and what level of classification it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sometimes a very fine line. And as long as you don't cross over that line, you're okay. They can't do anything about it. And the more you know about the contracts, the provisions of that contract, the closer you can get to that line without violating it.
Mm-hmm.
So, it, you know, it's just sort of a go no go gauge, if you know what a go no go gauge is. The hole has to be so big to put the widget in. So you have a tool in your pocket that's the size of the hole. And if it won't fit in the hole, it doesn't go. So that would be a simple go no go gauge. If you violate the terms of the contract, no go. If you don't violate it, nobody cares.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as he didn't violate anything where he really got in trouble for it, which he did, they didn't charge him with anything. They could have easily charged him with various crimes, and they chose not to. So as long as they don't, it's as if nothing ever happened.
Mm-hmm. One, I guess, in order to deny him these contracts, or would be to acknowledge that his whole story in the first place.
Yeah, that would be confirmation of the best kind. And I'm sure you or anybody else that you got fired from a big job and they said it was because of this specific thing, in these days of litigious actions, you want to take that to court. Well, they fired me improperly.
Mm-hmm.
And that means a lot of that stuff would potentially leak out. So, yeah, I just can't see him finding a judge with a top secret clearance and a need to know. So, because it's not something you want to do, is you don't want to reveal state secrets, but by the same token, as long as you don't cross that line, you're pretty well okay.
Mm-hmm. And my last question about Lazar is, just kind of your thoughts, because you know, one of the big controversies is whether or not he has these degrees, like at Caltech and MIT, like he claims. Did he ever tell you that, or do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I never. That never came up. It just is the way he acted, believed, and the skill sets that he had, and which is very little demonstrated. I mean, we didn't go out and set up a lab or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't anything I didn't have any reason to doubt him, and it never came up in any discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I guess the last thing I want to talk about in the few minutes that we have is that, you know, we met out in Roswell, and kind of your interest or connection to the Roswell incident.
Yeah, it was an interesting time. It still is for me. Back when the Earth's crust was still cooling, 97, I think it was, George Filer used Filer's Files. If your listeners don't subscribe to that, they should. And send George a donation for doing all this good work, was contacted by General Ramey's widow. And she was upset because someone had told her sons, General Ramey's sons, that he was a liar and he had lied to the American public. And she wanted to know, is that true? What's going on? And so George knew the photographer, James Bond Johnson, who took the pictures in General Ramey's office of the what is supposedly the crashed UFO debris, and along with General Ramey, Colonel DuBose, Major Marcel, and the warrant officer, Irving Newton. And so George called Bond and said, I know you took the pictures. What was it? And Bond just barely remembered it because it was like a little blip on his radar screen, so to speak. He took the pictures. There was a lot of excitement. And hours later, General Ramey said it was a weather balloon. And nobody thought about it until 1980 when Bill Moore, St. Bill Moore, we talked about earlier, and William Berlitz wrote the book, The Roswell Incident. And in the Roswell incident, it's a really lousy photo. And the debris is mostly clipped off, a lot of the debris at the bottom of the photo, because it's showing that the people in the photo as opposed to the debris. Mm-hmm. And so Bond had seen me lecture on something. I don't know what it was. I was with the Orange County MUFON, and there were several of us that if we couldn't find a guest speaker for cheap, we'd each rotate talking about something related to UFOs. And he liked the way I worked and what I presented, so he asked me to help him investigate photographs. So we ordered photographs and went down to Kinko's and got an enlargement, and we just happened to serendipitously find the one little portion of the photo that showed what looked for all the world to be an I-beam with strange glyphs or symbols in it, which was what was one of the things described by Jesse Marcel Jr. as his finding when he looked at the stuff his dad brought back. So anyway, that led to ordering 16 by 20 prints, big large prints, and which is the largest size they offer at the university, and looking into those with great detail. We contacted, we being James Bond Johnson, the photographer, and I contacted Neil Morris in the United Kingdom. He works at he's in charge of the lab for the astronomy and physics department at the University of Manchester. And Dave Rudiak said stuff got him interested in it. I don't know if Tom Burleson got involved because of us, but then Marilyn Rubin, Andrew Lefoe in Canada, several other people more or less seriously, but I was facilitator for this, and we started looking at these things in detail, and we found some rather startling things. The bottom line is that the two pictures of Marcel, even though Bond thought he had taken them, he did not take them. They were shot with a different focal length lens, and if he would have taken them with his speed graphic, he would have had to have quite literally turned his speed graphic camera upside down and take the pictures, something nobody would do, no purpose for it, because the image of the negative holder is upside down from what it would have been speed graphic. So we can rule out that. We found out the precise time of day within 10 minutes when the pictures were taken by analyzing the shadow of a viewing bumper that was shown in one of the through the peeking through the curtains in one of the photographs. We found lots of strange glyphs and symbols, some of which are repeated. We found that there's nothing in the pictures of General Ramey and Colonel DuBose that correlates in any way with a crashed weather balloon, or turned to Vogel device. I say weather balloon because that's what it was the explanation given the second time. The first time they said it was a flying saucer that they captured, a flying disc. Second time it was a weather gadget. The third time it was a mogul weather balloon. And I don't know. That said, it was a crash test dummy, so they haven't made a picture yet.
And the pictures you're referring to are the iconic ones that now, if you Google, for instance, Roswell and look at the images, you're going to see these pictures.
Right. And I've got these beautiful 16 by 20 prints. Now, there's an interesting little side on this was one of the prints apparently was sent to Bettman Archives in New York the evening they were taken. However, before they could get them in the morning, they were arrived too late to make the evening edition, we're speculating, but way early enough to make the morning edition. But in between, General Ramey, as the Roswell Daily Record so eloquently puts it, eat the Roswell saucer. I got on, had a news conference, said all this was a big mistake. Those guys over at Roswell just saw a weather gadget from a flying saucer. Sorry about that, folks. Nothing to see here. Move on. And that's when we believe there was a press conference, because Bond swore up and down. He was the only one there. There was no other photographer. He would arrange the debris. He took photographs of it. He did not remember seeing Marcel at first, but after he'd been interviewed several times and told, well, you were there, and there's the pictures you must have taken. He said, yeah, I probably did. And then later on, he became convinced he did, until we proved otherwise. And then he said, well, maybe I didn't. So, but it was... I lost my train of thought. I got totally derailed there.
But essentially, I mean, you guys have looked at these pictures, and like you said, you found that there were more pictures. There were more pictures than Johnson had taken, and in some of these pictures, you feel then perhaps there was some of the real flying saucer debris and not the weather balloon.
And the pictures with General Ramey, that's the real stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Not a weather gadget, not a mogul, not anything the Air Force said it was. The Bettman photo, by the way, is what I was discussing, was sent to New York, never made it to print. We found it strictly by mistake when somebody was combing the Bettman archives in 1997 and found it and published it in one of these coffee table books about UFOs. And it revealed some 3/4 inch to 3/8 inch thick material in the debris in the photographs with General Ramey and Colonel DuBose. So we quickly checked the photographs taken that we received from the archives at University of Texas Arlington, and those same areas of the photographs appear to have been doctored in some manner or degree to remove any vestiges of that thickened material. So it looks like here's another case where somebody somehow went in and modified the photographs.
Yeah, weird.
Yeah, or the decadence, I should say, not the photograph. So, talking with the archivist, and they swear up and down that those decadence have never left their hands since they got them from the Star Telegram. So it appears that quite early, maybe within days of Bond taking the photographs, somebody at the Star Telegram went in and modified the negatives. Remember, by this time, the beautiful print had been sent to Bettman.
Mm-hmm.
So before they went to University of Texas Arlington, became part of their archives, it appears that somebody was able to go in and modify the negatives to take out that incriminating thick pieces of metal. Another thing that I found that we did that was interesting, I got 5 or 6 different blow-ups of different areas of strange stuff. One I call a switch cover, there's one that looks like a chrome strip, there's another that looks like an I-beam, and drop of, well, I did send that one. So there's 5 photographs I sent to Professor Moore, Charles Moore, who was in charge of the Mogul balloon launches and claims that, yep, that stuff in those photos is part of my balloon program. So I sent him these enlargements to these specific areas, and I asked him quite candidly, you know, what part of the Mogul are these taken from? And he says, I've never seen that stuff before, and, well, that I-beam looks, it looks like an I-beam with symbols in it. I mean, he agreed that part of one of the photographs of what he was working on, so everybody says, had an I-beam with symbols in it. Yet there is no, nothing like that on any Mogul balloon.
So he confirmed that that's not a Mogul balloon.
Those pictures were not of anything that he worked with, yeah.
Wow, how interesting. Well, we're out of time, but good work. I mean, this is just so terribly interesting, and I know the listeners are going to love it, but just a lot of amazing stuff. So what an amazing life you've led, and now you're retired out there in Flagstaff, right? Just taking it easy?
I am, and I'm writing this all down. Neil Morris and I in Great Britain are writing our book, and we're putting all of these findings in a book. We hope to have an electronic version so we can put some high-res TIFF images in it. And we're inviting anybody and everybody who wishes to analyze this, these photos, get a read on the Ramey office memo that we did. Do all this stuff. You know, we didn't do any computer wizardry or gimmickry. We used shade contrast, brightness, and magnification. That was it. That's the extent of our computer wizardry on these images.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody could do that with a laptop.
Is there a website people can go to see your work?
No, I'm too lazy to do one. Sorry about that. I'm retired. I'm having fun. As we're conducting this interview, I'm looking out my office window, and I'm watching baby quail about the size of golf balls running around with their mama. And I'm enjoying life and part-time spending writing the book, and maybe one of these days I'll get a web page built.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, enjoy your retirement. It's been wonderful talking to you. I'm sure we'll see each other again soon. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Alejandro. And everybody that's listening, God bless and enjoy life.
Thank you so much to Ron for being on the show. What an interesting guy, huh? I mean, all these things he's ran into, some of the most important stories when it comes to ufology, and he's had some insight or just kind of played a role just by going along and doing what he does, doing his job. So really interesting stories. I'm so happy that I finally got to catch up with Ron and talk about some of this. So thank you very much. Let's see what else is going on. Of course, we got the UFO Congress coming up here. We'll be listing speakers probably within the next week or two. We have them mostly worked out, and it's going to be very exciting. You guys are going to really love that the speakers that we have. And once I post those, be sure to register as soon as possible. In fact, register quick because we have more registrations right now already for the conference than we've ever had this early on before. So really exciting. And this is going to be another great year for the UFO Congress. Also, this is kind of cool. So this weekend, I'm going to be going to Vegas. Yeah. So if you want to see me party it up, actually, I don't really party too much. I don't know how many of you even know. I don't really drink. I drink like maybe 2 drinks a month. So I'm not the best partier. I'm going to admit that because I like to kind of take it easy and stay sober. I'm usually the designated driver guy. But still, it's going to be a lot of fun. And here's why. We're going to be going to see Ruben Uriarte and Noe Torres speaking at the National Atomic Testing Museum. So I've talked about this place before. In fact, I interviewed some of you will remember this, the guy who used to run it. He recently retired. But he had installed an Area 51 display that they still have there. That's really cool. It's supposed to be about Area 51. But this guy who runs a museum, which is sponsored by the Smithsonian,
by the way. He's so into UFOs that it's mostly about UFOs and not Area 51. So a lot of UFO stuff there. In fact, he's even got, because it's the home of George Knapp, you know, the investigative reporter for KLAS there in Las Vegas. George Knapp has done a lot of work with Russian UFO researchers, and one of them gave him metal that they believe came from a spacecraft, and that is in this museum at the National Atomic Testing Museum. So you can go there and you could take a look at that and get a great talk from Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte. So that'll be a lot of fun. Ruben, as you may remember, was a speaker at last year's UFO Congress, well, actually this year, 2015, and he was also on the UFO Jeopardy, which was a lot of fun, at the UFO Congress. So Ruben's a great guy. We've interviewed him before. We've had him and Noe on the show before. So great couple of guys. I'm really excited to go out there and help support these UFO talks that they do out there and help support Ruben and Noe. And so if you're in the area, you know, swing on by and come check this out. This is going to be a lot of fun. And it's another excuse for me to go to Las Vegas. Actually, my girlfriend's going to be out of town, so I'm going to be going with Clifford Mahoudi. Some of you guys might remember him. I've had him on the show as well, and he spoke at the Congress. Really neat guy, a Zuni elder, good friend out here in this area. So we're going to be road tripping, so that's going to be a lot of fun. But I encourage you, yeah, to come out if you can. Otherwise, you know, thank you to all of you listeners. Thank you to Dark Matter Radio, who is the home of Art Bell's podcast radio show that's going to be starting up here in just like a week or two. So that's really exciting for the Dark Matter Digital Network. Again, thank you guys for playing our shows. And this ought to be really exciting. You know, I was listening to some Art Bell interviews not too long ago, and he's just great. You know, he's his voice is great. He's a lot of fun. What an interesting guy. So it's going to be so exciting to have him back on the air. So congratulations to Dark Matter. This is going to be a lot of fun. And thank you at Dark Matter, too, for not just playing the show, but being such a good friends. They're good friends of ours here at Open Minds. So really good group of guys. And, of course, that's where Martin Willis has his show, Podcast UFO. And thank you to Martin for joining us with the news. Thank you to Caleb Hanks, who does the opening and close music. You can find him at Clerk Chronicles, and you can find a link to the Clerk Chronicles at the on the radio page on the openminds.tv website. And, of course, you can find all of the news that Martin and I talked about earlier in the show at openminds.tv, where we post UFO news on a daily basis. For more about the UFO Congress also, and if you want to keep up on that, go to ufocongress.com. And I should let you know also that our email list has kind of been reignited. So now we are sending out emails to let you know what we're up to on a more regular basis. We give you the latest on the Congress. We give you the latest on some of the cool stories on the website. We give you the latest on what we cover on our UFO report. That is our video UFO news thing that we do on YouTube. And we give you updates to the UFO Congress and some of the sales and stuff that you can find at our shop. So we update you on all of everything that's going on that we do on our email list. You can join the email list by going to openminds.tv, and up in the right-hand corner, you'll see a little box that says join the email list. You can put your email in there, click submit, you're good to go, or contact us. You can call us, you can email us and say, hey, put me on the list, and we'll do that, no problem. So keep up to date with what's going on with us. So you can know all of the cool stuff. I don't know of anybody, not to brag here. Well, I guess not to brag, but to advertise, to kind of plug. I don't know any other site that kind of keeps people up to date in all of these different fronts and all of these different medias like we do. So, and we're really happy to do it. And we are so happy to have so many viewers and listeners who enjoy our work. Really, the vast majority
of what we do, we put out there for free because we really have a genuine interest in sharing this information and letting you know what's going on out there. And some people complain about what we don't have for free, but of course we do have expenses, very big expenses, which we don't meet. We're not a profitable company, people, so quit complaining about having to throw us a few bucks to help us out to keep going. So we're just very fortunate to have a sponsor, an owner, who is interested in this topic and willing to spend some money to get this information to you. So that's great. And my hat's off to my boss, John Rayo. Hopefully he'll hear this and feel touched and give me a raise. But anyway, thank you all so much for joining us this week. Join us next week for another exciting show. Adios, muchachos. Emotion and sound, the glass.